This is an oral history interview with Mr. George Kaufman, conducted by Tom Chapelo on 12 November 1994. Subject of the interview is Second World War and post-war defense industry in Alabama. The interview is conducted in Anniston, Alabama.
Well, just prior to the war, in the north, in Pennsylvania, I was working in a machine shop making 8-inch armor-piercing shells at about $15 an hour. That's the way it turned out. In Alabama, I was running a machine shop on a second shift at Anniston, Alabama, and I was making 75 cents an hour.
Burning
turret lathes, yeah, after the war.
Not immediately after.
Immediately after, yeah. We still had tail, you know, under contract, making bomb fuses for the bombs that were made at Kilby, the fuses.
Uh-huh.
That's what I made in Alabama. So the difference in the is in the taxation in Alabama, it was almost non-existent. I don't pay any tax here except on that acre there that's in the city.
Uh-huh.
It's only about $2 or something. People over 65 have the advantage in Alabama over other states where they're taxed to death regardless of age. You understand me?
Yeah.
That's why I'm here. I can't afford to live anywhere else.
I'm not going to...
If you talk about... difference between Alabama and Pennsylvania, and that's two widely separated states there, see? South and North. Well, Pennsylvania's not exactly North, but it ain't South either. Middle state. They have a tax on... They have personal tax. They have township tax. They have county tax. There's more damn taxes in Pennsylvania you can't enumerate, and where the hell does it go? See?
Yeah.
Here, there is no such a thing. I don't worry about it. I ain't got the money anyway to pay it, see? You can't build up no bank account in Pennsylvania. The tax people already got it planned in their favor, see?
This house here...
I left property in Pennsylvania... because it was no use me trying to keep up on it. I had a partnership up there in a building operation. Maybe I dropped $30,000-$40,000 in one whack. It didn't matter to me. You couldn't hang on to it anyway. Tax people already beat you to it, see? And the federal government, here, that's the worst tax you got here, the federal government tax. Half of my wife's salary goes for taxes.
That's why you ended up in Alabama after the war.
No, not particularly. I mean, there's no particular reason. There's no particular reason. I just happened to be here. See,
uh-huh.
I was wounded. I had a. You couldn't go to a bank on your veterans. Thing, you know, you couldn't go, I'm a veteran, I need to borrow some money. You couldn't do that, see? They wouldn't give it to you. I wanted to build a house and get a place to live. So what I had to do, I got $275 for all this land, see?
Uh-huh.
With a good deed. You just happened to have a good deed to it on this land here.
Then the house was not on it when you bought it.
No, I built... This is the second house I built. I did this myself.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about
that. Well, the old lady did this. She lived... We had a tent. She lived in a tent, her people. They've been to Louisiana and then back. See, she wasn't born here either. She was born in Georgia.
Immediately after the war, during the war, Alabama's industry had almost completely adapted to wartime production. And they are, that's what I've heard anyhow. And
But they had a hell of a time getting anything past the government inspectors. It was no good.
Oh, really?
The work was shoddy. Poor work. They didn't have the experience. All they had in Alabama was a pipe shop type machinist. You know, they weren't engineers.
They weren't keeping.
In other words, you had to have a boss for almost every two or three men. Some guy that had the best of the ideas to get them to work. See, on these fuses, that thing's running. I'm getting off the track. These fuses had some number 60 holes bored in them at an angle, see?
Uh-huh.
This is done with a drill press, automatic drill press. I set it, and they had a guy in there smoking, wanting to smoke all the time. Well, you can't smoke around oil, you know. I wouldn't allow that. Even at that time, I smoked myself, see, but I wouldn't allow nobody. Here come my kin folks. And it's hard for people, you know, in the North to understand that you're coming from an agrarian type existence into the 20th century, which was industrialized. The South is not industrialized. We were still paying war taxes in the Civil War. And you can figure it wasn't that high. We even had tokens, you know, and things like that. What tokens are? They're made out of aluminum and plastic to help out a little bit, so you could split a penny into 10 different equal parts, you know. So the economy was tight here, real tight. People were used to living from hand to mouth, you know.
During the war, a lot of new industry came to the state, like the armories up in Huntsville. And they expanded Fort McClellan.
Well, it was not well organized, you know, at the beginning of the war. Towards the end of the war, it became more of an industry. But it was everything depended on the damn whims of the government.
Right, and when the war ended, what effect did that have on it? Did these things close, or did the perceived threat of the Soviet Union keep the war industry alive?
No, the war industry was not alive. It died right after the war, when the war ended. When the war with Japan, ended by the...
Mm-hmm.
I was a supervisor in a machine shop downtown here, Moore Avenue, and we had orders to quit, stop production. As soon as the war ended, we stopped production. The lathes belonged to the government. See, they were leased by the local businessman, Charlie Hamilton. He was the main man here, and for the legal part. Cy Young was the main man in Anniston. You understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You have the business, and you have, and it just crept. It didn't move because they didn't have the intelligence, or they didn't have the training, I'll put it that way, to operate machinery like lathes. You know, turret lathes are fast operating machines. It has to spin. See, it has to go against the moon. For instance, Walter Cockrell, he was on a day shift, and he was a pipe shop machinist, which they didn't deal in thousands of an inch or parts of a thousandth. They dealt in rough figures, rough machine work, and he was involved there, and. He was trying to run a turret lathe, you know, like a engine lathe, at a slow speed, see? They wouldn't operate like that. So he never made anything. Everything he made was rejected by the government. See, the government came in and inspected. We made a bomb fuse about that round and about that big. It went on the front of a shell, a bomb, you know, that Kilby was trying to make. Whether they ever got any bombs through Kilby, I don't know. their piercing process was no good, see. It run. They had difficulty. They were 50 years, 100 years behind the Bethlehem Steel, see, in the manufacturing techniques. You take the Bethlehem Steel, when they made a bomb, a 500-pound bomb, they extruded it by extrusion methods. They didn't have that. Their extrusion, the way that was done, they took a block of steel and they heated it in the oven. See, they pulled it out and set it in a die here, and it went through a die with a ram, and it left a certain thickness on the front, which was called an extrusion. The whole bomb was extruded from a piece of a single block of steel. And then it dropped off of that machine onto another machine, which was a welder, like a burning process. Burnt the back end off nice and round, you know. When you extrude something, you have a sleeve here that's all misshapen at the back here. So they cut that round, so when they close it in, it come down like this, see, and out and then down. And the veins went on there. That's just, and then the shells. I was in the industry at the time. We were trying to produce a 8-inch shell, a 16-inch shell for the Navy. Mostly my work was for the Navy, you know. Our inspector was a Navy lieutenant, various ranks of the Navy. We produce, an 8-inch shell, and we sent it down to Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland, not too far away. Okay, they shoot it in the armor plate and give us the results of that. And then, in other words, we were all tied together, you know, like a unit. See, we knew what was going on here, what was going on there, and I was instrumental in improving the method of boring the hole for the explosive in an 8-inch shell. And a 16-inch shell was the same, but it was bigger in bomb making. You know, a 2,000-pound bomb, you can walk in and out of it. It's huge. So, there's a lot of detail work went into the boring of the 8-inch armor piercing shell for the Navy, and it would be extraneous for me to try to elaborate on all that crap. See?
But essentially, the manpower that you had in Alabama wasn't skilled enough to do that.
No. They didn't have the machinery either. Uh-huh. They didn't have the technique, they didn't have the training, they didn't have the machinery, they didn't have the knowledge.
The machinery
to go into anything big, you know. Small, like a bomb fuse or anything, but that was a 16-tool setup, see. Very difficult to set it up. And once something broke down about it, you know, it took maybe sometimes days to get it back in operation again. It wasn't the tape type machine where everything's on a tape. On a sealed tape, you know, they didn't have that. When that came in, it came in at Rock Island, Rock Island is out in the Mississippi River there. It had several operators. That was that process became mechanized that it only had three or four men working in a huge building. To keep the tapes changed, you know, and make anything they wanted to make. Steel came down, went into the lathe, the product was made, you know, and was right to the exact tolerances. Because if anything wasn't right about the tolerance, it would cut the machine would cut itself off. A man came there and reset the tools, see, the cutting tools, and things like that.
Immediately after the war, did the Anniston area military industry, the Fort and the Depot,
How much did they cut back production when the Japs surrendered?